Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thanks to Think.
From digital signage to audiovisual solutions,
we've thought of everything.
Visit thinkpm.ie.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, cybersecurity expert Ronan Murphy joins me to talk about ransomware and should you pay if you get attacked. John Riley will explain the Epic row between Apple and Epic Games. Plus, we'll chat about your rights if your employer seeks to install monitoring software on your work device. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. A very busy show as ever, so we're going to jump right in with Ronan Murphy from Smart Tech 24/7. Ronan, the last time you were on, we were talking through all different kinds of cybersecurity concerns, and you told a brilliant but horrific story about one individual who was scammed out of a lot of money. But I want to focus in today on ransomware and should you pay or should you not pay when you are targeted. Before we get into the do's and don'ts, can you just explain very simply, you know, what is ransomware and how does it differ to some of the other cybersecurity threats that are out there?
Hi, Jess. Yeah, so ransomware works by encrypting a victim's data. Typically, hackers get into a network via email or a user clicks on a link. And once they get into the network, they encrypt all of the user's data and then they'll offer the victim a way to decrypt that data, which we call a key. In return for payment, which is typically in the form of a cryptocurrency payment. And the cost can be quite substantial, as we've seen with this issue in the US.
So how does this happen? Because you think that, you know, we're all pretty wise now when it comes to spotting anything that might go awry on our laptop. But I've heard instances of people who just open their laptop one day and all of a sudden there's a message that says that their stuff is encrypted and they have to pay. How exactly do the hackers get access to the files to encrypt them in the first place?
Yes, yeah, so there's many different techniques. The techniques that I've discussed with you on the show many times are social engineering techniques where they'll compromise a user via email or social media. But these guys are getting more sophisticated. They're getting much better. And interestingly, how they're now infiltrating users and networks is they're actually hacking them. So they're scanning their systems externally and they're not even relying on users to click on links. They're finding vulnerabilities, they're exploiting those vulnerabilities, they're gaining access to the network. And then once they get in, that's where they're creating all of the damage. So they're upping the bar in terms of the approach that they're taking towards the industry and exploiting the problem that exists.
That all sounds absolutely terrifying. Like, it would actually make you just want to go back to a pad and paper and forget the whole laptop thing, because businesses in particular would know that if you were targeted by this, it can be utterly petrifying, because that's essentially your livelihood that lives in whether it is a device, a server, anything like that. So to be targeted, it's pretty scary, to put it mildly. What are the preventative measures that you can put in place to try and stop this? And is there such a thing as 100% bulletproof to prevent ransomware attacks?
Just before we get into preventing, I think it's important and not to, you know, to freak out listeners too much, but this is even worse than people have anticipated, right? Because traditionally, ransomware, the fallout from ransomware was that they would encrypt your data and then hopefully you had a backup of your data. And if you didn't have a backup, then you had to consider, you know, potential payment, right? But they've now ramped it up a level, right? And they're following what they call the double extortion trend. And what that means is that they're now no longer just encrypting your data, but they're also exfiltrating your data. They're taking it. And what they're then doing is they're blackmailing you to say, well, if you want your data back, you have to pay us. And if you don't pay us, we're going to make all of your data public. So that could be your patients, it could be your customers, it could be confidential information. And you can imagine the profound implications that has for a business in terms of legals, in terms of compliance. The fallout is really, really important and serious. And even your suppliers and your customers, everything about it. So this is the severity of this has grown significantly, I would say. It's this double extortion trend, right?
Can I just ask on that though, Ronan? So if that were to happen, say if I had a company, right, and I was hacked and that exact scenario that you just painted the picture of there happened, from a data protection point of view, am I liable if all my customer information ends up online or if it ends up in the hands of bad people and so on?
Well, you're not liable because you got hacked, right? That's a common misconception, right? If you've done the very best you can do and you can demonstrate to regulators that you've taken the best steps to try and protect yourself, then you know your liability is reduced, right? But nonetheless, it creates significant problems for you. Typically, if I'd been talking to you, Jess, 18 months ago, I would have been saying to you, right, how we deal with ransomware is you back up your data, you train your users and you back up your data. Mm. We're now having a completely different conversation. We're now saying, you know what, it's no longer enough just to back up your data, because if these guys extract your data off the network, your backup is no good to you, because they're now blackmailing you because they're going to make your data public.
That's terrifying. Like, it's actually terrifying when you think of the ramifications of this, as you mentioned, from a reputational point of view, from a compliance point of view, all of those different things. It is terrifying. And I know that a number of businesses around the country do feel very vulnerable, because although we talk about it very casually now, you know, all of this sort of stuff, it's still quite new, isn't it, really? And there are a number of businesses around the country that have really only moved to more digital solutions and gone through that digital transformation in the last number of years. So having to think and fear ransomware attacks, it is quite scary. So you're saying now that the backup isn't enough. What is enough? Like, is there anything that'll prevent it?
Yes. So, I mean, we've spent a lot of time looking at these guys, DarkSide, the guys who committed this very high profile ransomware attack on the Colonial Pipeline. And what you'll notice about them is on their websites and their underground forums, they're actively trying to hire hackers and penetration testers and vulnerability scanning teams. And then they very clearly pick out specific industries that they target. And I mean, they're quite professional in how they portrayed the organization. The group has a phone number, they have a help desk, they have negotiators for dealing with the victims, and they come across as a very professional outfit. They even have a code of conduct. I mean, it's crazy. They have they've even made donations to charity with some of the ransoms they've been paid, right? And they say they don't go after, you know, schools and universities and not for profits. No, by the way, I wouldn't believe that. But so how do you deal with this, right? Well, my advice would be you just need to be better than the company next door to you, right? Meaning you obviously need to back up your data. You need to understand where your data is and what that data is. If you've got data that's very sensitive in terms of containing intellectual property or your crown jewels or whatever it might be, then there's extra security precautions around that data. You encrypt it, you understand where it is, you build as much protection around it as possible. Because again, backup is no longer enough because of this double extortion trend that we're seeing. And organizations really have to start looking at security from a vulnerability perspective, a patching perspective, a penetration perspective. And it needs to become a really important part of the overall business strategy, as important as sales and marketing and so forth, you know.
Okay. And is this something that needs to be built into the DNA of a company and not just something that you do when you hear something like WannaCry doing the rounds, that as we had a few years ago?
It is, because these guys are making so much money. I mean, it's so lucrative. They're only getting better. They're investing more. They're hiring more people. The problem is growing. And another really interesting thing, Jess, that you need to understand about this ransomware attack is that these guys, DarkSide, they're ransomware as a service. So, I mean, you know, I said this to you before, but you, if you decided to pack up News Talk tomorrow and become a hacker, which I'm sure you have the technical acumen to do, you could call
that.
These guys DarkSide and say, listen, I'd like to become one of your customers and I'd like to start buying your software and start up my own encryption business. So this problem is only getting bigger. And organized crime syndicates are getting access to these guys. They're getting access to the technology. So to your point, I would say yes, security has to become part of the DNA within an organization. And very importantly, as companies, you know, embrace digital transformation and they start moving to the cloud, the what we term as the attack surface, it's the way to, you know, break into your organization, whether it's through your users or your network or your applications or your cloud, that increases and the gaps increase and the vulnerabilities increase. And it's something that has to be taken very, very seriously. And I mean, this Colonial Pipeline hack is a really important example. I mean, you know, 5,500 miles of pipeline being shut down across the Gulf Coast. It's crazy, you know.
But I want to kind of stress to people as well, though, that although we're talking about this because of the Colonial Pipe attack, these types of attacks are happening every single day. I think if we were to chat about every ransomware attack that was going on around the world, we'd be on the phone all day, every day, wouldn't we?
Oh, it's unrelenting. I mean, there's literally thousands of these attacks taking place every week. The vast majority of them go under the radar, so they're not publicized. And I mean, the reason why the Colonial Pipeline one is publicized is people are unable to get fuel, and the impact is enormous, and it's very high profile. But these are happening every day of the week in every industry, across healthcare, manufacturing, retail, finance, to small businesses, to large businesses. And it's no longer a case of, look, keep your head down and, you know, we might not become a victim. It's, you know, everybody's a potential victim here, you know.
And without wanting to scare the bejesus out of everyone, the term cyber war, I mean, is it realistic or is it overdramatic of me to say that potentially we could have a ransomware attack that holds an entire country to ransom unless money is paid?
I think that's a little bit overdramatic, I would say, because if you look at a country like Ireland, for example, all of our utility providers they're all separated, right? So, you know, you'd have to be able to successfully attack the electricity supply board, the water utilities, the gas utilities, the banking systems. And the reality of being able to coordinate an attack on all of those systems concurrently, it's not really in anybody's interest. It's certainly of value to the guys who are going to, you know, have a ransomware attack. But I would say that from a nation state perspective, it's more about espionage. It's more about trying to steal IP and spy on specific governments. And, you know, the Americans do it, the Russians do it, the Chinese do it, the Brits do it. It's standard practice. It's the new way of how these guys operate in that grey realm.
Yeah, it's very grey. One other type of ransomware that individuals may have come across, and it was very prevalent a number of years ago, whereby you turn on your laptop and this message pops up. And I can't remember exactly, but I think it said like FBI warning, we know what you've been doing on your laptop and your device has been encrypted unless you pay. And it's very much targeted at the Joe Soap, the average consumer. Have those types of targeting gone away? And is there a workaround when that arrives onto your device?
Yeah, you know what they've been replaced with, funnily enough? They've been replaced with hijacking of social media accounts.
Oh.
So you get influencers, and they've spent a lot of time, energy and effort in building up a a public persona on whatever it might be, TikTok or Instagram or one of these social media platforms. And yeah, they've started hijacking those. And if you lose access to those accounts, it can be, you know, they get typically get disabled, and it's pretty hard to get, you know, Facebook or whoever it is to reinstate it. So they, you know, they have to build back up from the ground up. So they've become, hijacking of those accounts has become pretty prevalent. And I mean, the advice there is quite simple. You turn on two-factor authentication, and you make sure that if someone's trying to log into your social media account, you're getting a text message to your phone. So if I could give one bit of advice to listeners, it would be, it's very easy to do. Make sure you've two-factor authentication for everything, whether it's your Amazon account or your Instagram account or whatever it might be.
Okay, so let's ask the big question that I pose at the top of the show, the very top of the show. Do you pay or do you not pay when you are targeted by a ransomware attack?
Yeah, that's the $64 million question, right? So let me put a question back to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're a business and you've got 5,000 employees and all of your data is gone and your company has to shut down tomorrow, and everybody loses their job if you don't pay, do you pay or do you not pay? My advice would be not to pay. But I haven't been in a position where 5,000 people or 10,000 people are going to lose their jobs because a company is going to shut down.
I think I would pay, right? If you knew that they weren't going to be a bit dickish about it and go, well, actually, the ransom now has doubled or it's tripled or we're going to keep coming at you. And like, you're basically placing an element of trust between somebody that's quite literally holding your entire company to ransom.
Yeah, and I've done it many times. And it's very, very stressful. It's an unusual position to be in. But one of the advantages is that there's almost a degree of honor amongst thieves kind of approach with these guys.
Okay.
Where they know if they don't pay once, just once, nobody will ever pay them again.
Okay.
So for example, if you did some research on DarkSide, the guys that did the Colonial Pipeline ransomware, you'll see that they pay out every time, and they destroyed it. Well, they claim to destroy the data and not share it if you have paid. And when companies are a victim and they're looking to pay these guys $10 or $20 million, they'll look and they'll say, well, they have given the data before, and once they've given it, they haven't then shared it.
Yeah.
So if they ever don't pay, they immediately undermine their entire business model.
Mm-hmm.
So they tend to pay. But you are right. I mean, it's always a risk that they may not pay.
In terms of investigating, capturing, or whatever the heck it is, what is the success rate of tracking down who these hackers are? Because it, very often, and I have limited understanding of it, but I kind of get the impression that it's a network, and they are quite good at being seven steps ahead of whomever is coming after them, whether that is an individual, a business, or law enforcement.
So you've three people involved in this dance. You've governments, right? They're going to be much harder to go after, whether it's China or Russia or whoever. You then have the guys like DarkSide, who did the Colonial Pipeline attack, and they're the manufacturers of the software. So they put all of the infrastructure in place. And then you've got the consumers of their technology. And they could be organized crime syndicates, your everyday criminal. It could be your student in his bedroom. So it depends who you're going after, right? If you're going after a country, that's going to be kind of difficult. If you're going after a dark side type organization, you're dealing with, you know, very serious organized crime. Typically, you know, if it's somewhere in Russia, it's going to be a tough ask to get at them. And then you've got the guys who buy the software and use it as a service, and they're probably the easiest to catch.
Yeah, so it is a sophisticated operation, because if you do get the guy or the girl in her bedroom using the DarkSide software, for example, or their solution, it just means that that person is caught, but that doesn't stop the person two houses down from doing the exact same thing. So it is a bit more sophisticated. Right, well, that's all been utterly terrifying. Thanks for that, Ronan.
I want to give you a pro I want to give you a bit of a wild pro tip before I leave you, Jess.
Go on. But,
Part of the dark side code base for their encryption technology, it will not encrypt your system if it thinks it's a Russian system.
Ooh.
Because I guess they're a little bit afraid of what the fallout from Vladimir might be, right? So what you're getting some companies doing is they're installing Russian keyboards, which they do not need to use on their systems. So when the ransomware gets in, it'll check to see if there's a Russian, any Russian systems within the organization. And if there is, they will not run the encryption process. So if you really want to annoy Russian hackers, then you install a Russian keyboard on your system.
And by that, you mean just go into settings, go into languages, and then just add Russian as one of the languages, is it?
No, you actually have to download and install a separate Russian keyboard. It's a piece of software, but it's a pro tip, and it's a way to stop these specific types of ransomware from running in your system.
Well, that is a brilliant tip. That is, if it protects even one Tech Talk listener, then it's absolutely worthwhile. Ron, it's always terrifying but brilliant to chat to you. Thank you so much for joining us here on News Talk.
Thank you, Jess. Bye.
Tech Talk. Thanks to Think. From digital signage to audiovisual solutions, we've thought of everything. Visit thinkpm.ie.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address as ever if you want to get in touch, or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. We're going to talk gaming now. A lot of news this week, a lot of rumour as well. We're going to talk about what may be coming down the track from Nintendo in just a quick minute. But John Riley, editor of TheEffect.net, is with me now to talk about the epic row between Apple and Epic Games. John, you're very welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi, Jess.
Tell me a little bit about what's going on between Apple and Epic Games, for those who don't know what the background is here.
Yeah, so this is quite a significant, quite a milestone event happening in the gaming industry. It's a court case that's currently taking place in Los Angeles, and it just kicked off last week between Apple, who we all know, and Epic, who some people might not be aware of. Epic are one of the biggest players, really, no pun intended, in the gaming industry, and they're the guys that are behind the Fortnite game, which a lot more of your listeners will be aware of. So basically, if we go back to, I think, August of last year, it was kind of spotted that Fortnite were trying to sell their players, be it packages or game passes or battle pass, just basically trying to do microtransactions inside the Fortnite app without Apple actually getting a cut of the sale. And that really was seen to break Apple's terms and conditions as to what can be done on their app store, which we all know, or to anyone using an iPhone, is pretty locked off and enclosed. So Epic just said, this isn't on anymore. This isn't fair. You know, they have such a monopoly and such a control over what can and cannot be sold on their store that Epic have basically brought them to court saying that, you know, it's a monopoly. It's just not, it's not consumer friendly. It's not business friendly. And it's just not on. So that we're really in the thick of it now between the two companies.
Yeah. So this, and again, you may think, oh, here, what's going on? But this, although it is Apple versus Epic, it does actually impact pretty much any other app that wants to do in-app purchases going down the line or at the moment. Because as you mentioned there, if you're playing a game on your phone and you want to buy, whether it is coins or whatever the currency is within the application, the way it should work is that if you're on an iPhone or an iPad and you make that transaction, Apple should get a cut. Epic, as you mentioned there, aren't happy with this. What's Apple's stance on this? Is it just a money-making thing, or is it because they're concerned about user privacy and user protection? Because I know that they're doing a huge big push on that at the moment.
Well, I guess you could, yeah, you've kind of answered the question in terms of, yes, they could spin it in terms of the privacy, the security angle, and just kind of how well controlled their ecosystem is for the end user. But also it's a money grab. Like they're making hand over fist on the app store. Like it's absolutely bananas money. And like their profit or their operating margin for the app store is about nearly 80% for, like, I think fiscal year 2019 or even 2018. So this is like ridiculously high operating margins. So like they don't want to lose any of that kind of ground basically, or you lose any of that kind of income. So it's kind of, it's a double whammy that they're like, look, we want to protect our users. We want to make sure that everything is above board, but we also don't want to miss out on the profit that's being made, because, you know, we know Fortnite to be, as you know, your listeners will know it to be one of the, if not the, it's the biggest game in the world right now. And the money that's being made on that title, nobody wants to miss out on. So, you know, Apple aren't going to kind of secede to Epic's request. And, you know, Google and their App Store, obviously their Play Store, they did the same thing. They pulled Fortnite last year because of the same incident, because, you know, Epic were trying to just set up their own little stores inside the app that they didn't have to give a cut to. So that technically is, you know, that there is other ways to kind of download the Fortnite app outside of the Play Store on Android devices. But when it comes to iPhones, it's through the App Store or it's nothing else, basically.
And I know this is an important case, and we sort of talked through there some of the reasons why. But at the end of the day, this is one multi-million, if not billion-dollar company rowing with another billion-dollar company. And yet the only people who are really losing out at the moment is the people who are looking to play the game. Is that right?
That's it. Yeah, basically iOS users or iPhone, iPad users that are kind of big Fortnite fans are really the ones that are kind of caught in the middle of this kind of debacle. And it's a, you know, it's a money grabs from both companies. They both feel they're in the right. You know, Apple feel we created the ecosystem. We created the App Store from scratch. We made it accessible to millions and millions of developers. You're just like everyone else. Why should you get preferential treatment? Whereas Epic are saying it's not fair. You're really hindering consumer value here. Consumer competition and everything. So, you know, it's a head-to-head. Unfortunately, I think Apple are going to win, that they're going to just, you know, the court may rule in Apple's favor to say, look, it's their ecosystem. They're allowed to do what they do, what they want to do with it. It's their store. You can't come in and call the shots in terms of Epic. So it's very interesting. But yeah, it's going to set a precedent if it goes the other way, if Apple do have to give in to Epic's lawsuit.
We know that there's a lot of focus at the moment on the power and the clout that the big tech companies have. We know that Facebook in particular has been under huge pressure over the last 12 to 24 months in the US. There's been a lot of hearings at the Antitrust Committee looking at, you know, should Facebook be broken up into sub-companies rather than having this one big powerhouse? What do we think is going to come of this? And are Apple under the same kind of pressure? Are they tarred with that same brush of being a monopoly? Because a lot of us just think Apple iPhone, but there are so many other strands to that business. We heard recently at the product launch a few weeks back from Tim Cook that they're going to be doing a bit of a shakeup on the podcasting platform as well, introducing ways for people to subscribe, but also to kind of pay money to contributors and so on. So the streams of revenue for Apple continue to grow.
Yeah, no, it's like any kind of major hardware manufacturer, such, you know, Apple being one of the biggest in the world, they're realizing that people aren't upgrading their devices as often. You know, that it's really kind of plateauing in terms of what the end user needs in terms of power and displays and battery and whatever else, be it on their laptops, be it on their phones. So the profit margins on the hardware is slowly but surely just kind of slowing down. But it's really, as you said, the services, the subscription models, the everything else, the podcast setup, the App Store, obviously, is a huge moneymaker for Apple, that they're looking at any other way and all other ways they can kind of continue to keep the income flowing, the revenue streams flowing. And, you know, with the Apple TV Plus launch, you know, you've got a streaming service, you've got Apple Arcade, you've got kind of a gaming subscription service, all these different ways that, you know, Apple are trying to kind of branch out, as you said, that they're not just the iPhone maker. They do infinitely more, or even obviously the MacBook to the laptop users. But, you know, everything else is a play to kind of keep them relevant, to keep the money going and to keep them competitive against everyone else, really. So it's you know, everything is changing as the days go by and how people are kind of working to keep their business afloat, really, and how to kind of plan for the future. Because, as I said, phones aren't going to be, you know, people kind of don't need to have the latest and greatest as much as they used to, because the upgrades just aren't as significant. So other ways of building revenue really need to be developed, and that's what's happening, as we see with Apple.
Okay, so what's the timeline here, and what do we think is going to happen?
I think it's still ongoing. As I said, it's only kicked off last Monday, I think, or the 3rd of May. So we're early days somewhat yet, and a lot of kind of different industry players are you know, still taking to the stand from across the board. So it's still a while before we kind of going to get an outcome. But as I said earlier, I think unfortunately that the court is going to rule in Apple's favour to say they're allowed to set the fees, they're allowed to call the terms and conditions for their store, and if you're not happy about it, tough luck really for Epic. You know, the only company that really could put it to Apple is Epic, given their scale, their incomes, and this just the popularity of Fortnite right now. But you know, Fortnite is just one game. We never thought the likes of Battleground, PlayerUnknown, which was kind of Fortnite copied, which was one of the biggest, that kind of has somewhat succeeded into the background. Fortnite may kind of burn out in the coming years, and you know, Apple then can just say, well, we were right to stick to our guns. We didn't need to kind of bow down to their popularity right now, because all good things may not last forever. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the App Store is always going to be there for people to download their titles, and not just games, everything else as well on their devices. So it's loggerheads right now, but I think the judge will favor Apple in this one.
I'd love to hear what you think. Have you been impacted by this? Are you a Fortnite player that can't now access the game on your iPhone or your iPad? techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address. For the moment, John Riley, editor of TheEffect.net. Thanks so much for joining us here on Newstalk.
Thanks, Jess.
Tech Talk. Thanks to Think. From digital signage to audiovisual solutions, we've thought of everything. Visit thinkpm.ie.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on Newstalk. techtalk@newstalk.com is the email address if you'd like to get in touch, or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. I'm joined now by Linda Hines, who is a partner at employment law firm Lewis Silken. And Linda, you're very welcome to the show. This has been one of the big talking points of the week, and it's understandable, I suppose, that we are talking about it. It's understandable that there's levels of concern around it. Can you just give us a bit of an overview, or does an overview exist, I suppose, of at this moment in time, do employers have free rein to monitor the productivity of their employees?
No, absolutely not. And I think we have the benefit of being in Europe, in that we're covered under the General Data Protection Regulation. So that does really mean that any monitoring that an employer wants to do has to be lawful and transparent and fair and appropriate. So if there is a certain type of monitoring that an employer wants to put in place, there are certain steps they have to take before they can do that. So there's certainly no element of free rein. I do think there is an element of scaremongering, perhaps, in some of the attention we're seeing in terms of employee monitoring. And employee monitoring, the term itself, covers an awful lot of things. You know, for example, some monitoring may actually be helpful. You know, take, for example, during COVID, we had an increase in monitoring of employees when we were looking at health information. So that might have been gathering information on employee symptoms, cases of COVID, getting information on vulnerable employees, what are their travel plans, what's their temperature. All of that falls under employee monitoring, I think. It's just where that isn't seen as having a nefarious purpose. It just doesn't get the same level of attention as maybe productivity monitoring.
Yeah, because there's a few different aspects to this, I suppose. And when I just think about myself, so I'm a technology correspondent, I'm a reporter. I check in with my boss and I say, hey, I'm around. If a story crops up, give me a shout. If I'm going to record a report, or back in the day when I used to travel, I'd obviously give them an update of where I'd be, what I'd be doing, and the level of output, you know, like the reports that I would get. That's mm-hmm. more healthy communication from a business point of view, rather than them chipping me with a GPS so they can see when I'm running down the road to get a coffee. There is a distinction to be made, isn't there, between day-to-day management of people, and then there's the creepy side of stuff, which we will get to in a few minutes.
Exactly. And I think it's that creepy test that really determines what employers need to do in order to be able to implement the creepier type of monitoring. So you could have monitoring for various purposes. So it could be for data loss prevention purposes, security monitoring. And in fact, sometimes that can be quite intrusive. You know, that may even involve things like what kind of USBs are people plugging into their computers, taking screenshots of who's actually at the computer, those types of things. But the purpose of those would be data loss prevention, not necessarily productivity. The productivity monitoring is probably the one that gets the most bad press, because that can be quite intrusive. And ultimately, that is used to determine someone's performance and possibly determine the level of their remuneration, the level of their bonus, whether they're going to be performance managed or disciplined. So that has quite big impacts on employees. We do see other monitoring, and certainly in our practice, as COVID developed, when people were working remotely and perhaps were working in different countries, that maybe their employer didn't know where in the world they were carrying out their work. Because there were tax and legal implications of that, we did see an increase in employers looking to monitor employee device locations so that they could tally that up with where the employee had told them that they were working from to make sure there was no tax and legal risks. So we have seen a little bit of that. We've seen also an increase probably in diversity monitoring in terms of employee populations, and the queries we received on that probably increased further with the Black Lives Matters movement in the last 12 to 24 months. So those are different types of monitoring that you can see. Some of it is helpful to employees and some of it possibly less helpful for employees. It really depends on what the impact is to employees as to whether it's creepy or intrusive.
Yeah, and I understand from a business point of view the benefits of that type of monitoring that you mentioned there. And again, I understand it could be a pain in the face if there's a screenshot of your monitor taken every 5 or 10 minutes. But if you, as you said, if it's to ensure the safety and integrity of documents and data protection, then there is a valid argument there. The story that was sort of doing the rounds this week was about productivity monitoring. You know, how many, keys were you tapping on your keyboard per minute, per hour, per day? How many clicks of the mouse? That must be a bit of a tricky one, or I'd imagine it's a tricky one from a legal point of view, because obviously there's a number of varying factors there. And some of the scenarios, because I was on with Kieran Cudahy on the Hard Shoulder here on News Talk during the week talking about this, and they had Caroline McHenry from the HR Suite chatting about it as well. But if you think of different things, like, you know, some people are fast typers, some people are slow typers, some people are going to be working from home with 3 kids running around the place and they have to get up every 6 seconds to try and stop, you know, a glass of water or a glass of juice spilling over. There are so many different factors. So from a legal point of view, if a company tries to install this software, if they do install this software, as an employee, do I have a comeback saying, well, actually, you're not taking the circumstances, my personal circumstances, into account when you are putting it up against, you know, somebody who lives on their own, they have no distractions, and they're just naturally a highly productive person?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's probably 2 aspects to this from the legal side of things. So you have the data protection implications, which would firstly, you'd need to make sure the employee knows the type of monitoring that's going to happen and what that monitoring might be used for, what the results of the monitoring might be used for. I think then you, on the other side of the coin, you have the employment law implications and how those intersect with the monitoring. So productivity monitoring could ultimately have the opposite of its intended effects, because it potentially undermines the relationship of trust between the employee and the employer. Mm-hmm. So it's not a good substitute for people management. So it's probably not appropriate, I mean, depending on the industry, to rely on this type of monitoring solely as a measure of performance. And you would need to take mitigating circumstances into account if you were looking, say, to performance manage someone in that situation. So I think while it might be a helpful tool, it doesn't replace good management, and it shouldn't just be utilized on its own when you're managing employees.
Yeah, and I and this is not a scientific study in any way, shape or form, but I threw up an Instagram Q&A box the other day asking people what they thought of this type of software, and it was 100% absolutely no way. Some people went so far as to say, I would actually leave a company if they implemented this, because it's a clear sign that they don't trust, and you as an employee would have to ask, why are they so sketchy about it? And it does raise those questions. And again, I think they're all very valid questions.
Yes, absolutely. Well, in the war for talent as well, the fact that you use this type of software could very much go against you as an employer.
Yeah.
I think it would really be industry specific as to whether it's justified. And, the fact that you have to tell your employees about it in order to make sure you comply with GDPR, it shouldn't be covert. It should be transparent. Means they're less likely to accept it. I think certainly in Irish workplaces, it would be employees would be quite reluctant to accept productivity monitoring unless they're really clear on what it's going to be used for and they're comfortable with the type of monitoring that's put in place.
Yeah, and like Kieran gave the example the other day on the Hard Shoulder of people working in call centres. Like, you always hear the pre-recorded message before you talk to your bank or whatever it is, saying calls might be monitored for, you know, quality and whatever it is. And that's all, again, fair enough. You mentioned there about, you know, employers would have to tell employees that they're putting the software on the device. I assume there's absolutely no way in hell that an employer could force an employee to have this software put on their own device, because I know still a number of companies that haven't invested in enough equipment with people working from home and people are working off personal devices. I assume that's just an absolute no-no if an employer wanted to put this software on a personal device.
It would certainly be very challenging. And we are seeing an increase, say, on customers requiring companies to put this type of software on employee devices where the company is dealing with customer sensitive or sensitive commercial information. So we are seeing it more and more in customer contracts that this quite intrusive data loss prevention software would be put onto employee devices. And in the situations where I've seen that happen, you're usually talking about quite tech-savvy employees to begin with, mm-hmm. who are not allowing access to their camera and their audio on their laptop. And in those situations, big rollback from the bring your own device approach that previously was there, where the company, to provide comfort to the employees, has said, we'll give you separate company devices. These are purely for when you're working on this customer's requirements so that we can comply with the data loss prevention software they want us to install. And being very clear about how they can turn that off when they're not working. Because one of the risks with the remote working is that even if an employee agrees to this type of monitoring on their device, you could inadvertently get personal data on, you know, possibly their children or their roommate or whoever may be wandering around in the background while the camera is taking screenshots. So there are a lot of challenges for employers in trying to implement that. It's certainly difficult even where you're providing the devices, but very difficult where it's the employee's own devices because of that mix of the person, their own private personal data and the company data.
Yeah, the notion of having your camera triggered every few minutes, I just know myself and I just live with one person, that would be an absolute nightmare. And it's something that even when I'm having to do internal video calls with people here in Newstalk, there's times when I have to have my camera off because my partner's in the background hanging out the laundry or making a cup of tea. Like, you can't have people on 24/7, and you also can't then go and get every family member of an employee to sign a contract saying that they're okay with their data being taken every few minutes.
No, it's just like one of the risks with that is getting people's consent in the employment relationship is probably very difficult to rely on, because consent under GDPR is supposed to be freely given. Mm-hmm. And it's arguable in the employment relationship if employees can actually freely give consent, because your continued employment possibly rests on you agreeing to these policies.
Yeah.
So employers would have to look at other ways to justify that processing outside of having employee consent. And this is where, I think this is where some of the scaremongering probably should be reduced, because we do have protections under GDPR around that.
Yeah.
And where employers are putting in place, say, very intrusive or very new ways of monitoring their employees, they should be doing what's called a data privacy impact assessment. And that really is where they figure out, okay, well, what exactly is it we want to do? Why do we want to do it? What's the potential impacts on our employees? Is there ways that we can reduce that? And even as part of this, they have to think about, are there less intrusive things that we can do that would actually achieve the same purpose? And in my experience, those exercises are really good for employers, because mm-hmm. sometimes they really can tease out, is this actually a nice to have or is it a have to have in terms of the monitoring? Mm-hmm. And really does reduce the potential high risks that could be there initially, because I think probably what's happened is a lot of the software has just developed these amazing monitoring tools.
Yeah.
And it's been sold to employers. We now have these tools, you can use them, but employers still have an obligation to justify their use and go through that exercise to see, is this something that we should reasonably be doing? Our employees have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the workplace and they are protected by GDPR. So it's not anything that can just be rolled out wholesale without employees knowing about it or without a proper exercise being undertaken to justify that type of monitoring.
Yeah, like I think the story from this week, it got a lot of people up in arms. And I think, as I said at the top, I think that's Fair enough. However, we should just take a collective breath and realise that the likes of GDPR is there to protect us for a reason. So is it reasonable enough then if an employer says to an employee, look, we're going to start implementing elements of this. Is it reasonable for the employee to ask the why, the how much, how long is this data stored for? What is it going to be used for? What are the penalties if I don't meet a certain criteria? Is that a reasonable conversation to be had from a legal standpoint?
Absolutely. I mean, it's something that should probably be front loaded by the employer. So if they're carrying out that data privacy impact assessment, they'll actually have looked at a lot of those questions that employees will be raising. So they should be well prepared to answer those questions. They'll also have to include it in their privacy notice. So their employee privacy notice or their workplace privacy notice, which is the document that employers should have in place setting out all the types of processing of employee data that they do in the workplace. So it should be covered under there as well. Okay. So the transparency is key. A lot of information should be given to employees if you're thinking of implementing this type of monitoring.
Okay, so bottom line here is that, yes, it was a scary story, but no, we don't have we don't have to be too worried about it. Is that fair enough?
I think that's absolutely spot on. Yeah.
Brilliant stuff. Linda, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here on Tech Talk. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Jess. Good to speak to you.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. John Friday's up next here on News Talk. I'll chat to you next week.